Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flannelly. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland houses NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week. We had another busy week here at Glucksman Ireland House celebrating our graduates, and they're now graduates of our program, especially of our Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies. And we wish them well, and we look forward to a proper, non-socially distant party at some point soon. We're all missing our sense of community and camaraderie at One Washington Mews. Now, on this week's program, I'm delighted to bring a new book to your attention. It's called The Bowron, and I'm going to be speaking to the author of this book, Colin Hart. Colin has worked on this book for a number of years, evolving out of research for his master's. And to whet our appetites a little bit, we're going to hear some music that showcases the Bowron sound before we go into this interview and on the other side. And I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to share this conversation with you. I also want to draw your attention, folks, to the fact that on Thursday, the Irish government, in collaboration with Philip King and the Other Voices entity, showcased a performance by Glenn Hansard, and it was wonderful. It's on YouTube, folks, if you want to check it out, if you put the words Courage Glenn Hansard into your YouTube search engine, it should come up. And it reminded me of that wonderful time a number of years ago when Glenn Hansard sang at Glucksman Ireland House. So as we close out, I'm going to share with you Glenn Hansard and encourage you to watch and listen to that program from Thursday. Okay, folks, so into the Bowron. Thank you.
I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life Colin Hart. I'm introducing Colin as an ethnomusicologist, and today I'm interviewing him in the context of his new book, which is called The Bowron: Experimentation, Innovation, and the Traditional Irish Frame Drum. Welcome to the show, Colin, and thank you for making us aware of this beautiful new book from the University of Tennessee Press. Congratulations. You must feel good to be on this part of the journey with us.
Yes, I do. Thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
No, it's our pleasure. Would you mind telling me I shouldn't assume that all our listeners know that everybody knows what a Bowron is. Maybe we'll start at the beginning, and if you can tell us a little bit about this instrument and how you got onto this path of writing a book about it, Colin.
Sure. The Bowron is sort of a traditional frame drum in Ireland. It has a unique percussion tradition there, which the sort of domestic origins was thought to come from a sieve, sort of a farming tool there, which has a skin background, and eventually it worked its way into becoming a sort of ritual processional instrument, and with the emergence of Seán Airde and Pádraig Mercier, etc., was kind of brought to the general public in the 60s and became more and more popular as it became incorporated into different Irish traditional music ensembles. And so some people are in favor of it and seeing it as a sort of native instrument, other people not so much. But it's an accompaniment instrument. With each decade, really, from the 60s moving forward, there's been developments in the performance practices that go along with it and in the actual just construction of the drum. So the book was looking at the way in which this instrument has developed rather rapidly, particularly in the 20th century, going to the 21st, and seeing some of the sort of wild world of instrument making and experimentation in addition to the sort of way in which performers approach the drum. So that was the push. Initially, we started off with my master's research at the University of Limerick more than a decade ago, and I kind of just kept at it. Was initially going to develop it for an article, and you know, sometimes, as you know, you start pulling the thread and you interview another person and then another, and it just keeps leading you further and further down the line. And so by the time I was done with the interviews, I was chatting to the editor of this journal, and they said, I think you have a book here, not an article. And so then I, you know, said, well, I think you're right. I'm going to dive in, for better or for worse. So that was kind of the journey anyways.
So did you come to this, Colin? I don't know. I had the opportunity to speed read, I would say, the book that carefully yet. But I don't know if I missed it. In other words, were you coming from a background of playing the Bowron yourself?
So... like in the house, we always had traditional music, you know, playing, and well, I have three brothers, and they all play, you know, harp and fiddle and flute, and so I play piano mainly. We would play in the house, you know, I'd accompany my brother or something like this. But he had a Bowron in the house, just a very basic thing, and because of the weather here, it's quite dry, so the skin gets dry, so it was like playing a pizza box. So I didn't have much interest in it, and he'd play it, and, you know. But when I got to the University of Limerick, they were just all the students who get together to play, and we play different world musics along with trad, you know, Irish traditional music. So there was another piano player there. So we trade off. So when he was playing the piano, I wasn't just going to sit there. And I was already playing percussion. And had played the Bowron a bit. So I got into playing that, to accompany traditional music, and then really fell in love with the drum. I heard the possibilities for it and just stuck with it after that.
So you track, first of all, I mean, and you know, as I've explained to Colin, I'm no expert at all on Irish music, except having a pedestrian appreciation of it and things. So this is the first kind of dedicated study of the Beuron, though, in the way that you have done it. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, there's different publications and articles, but most of the publications were either comparative, like say the Beuron and the Lambig, or they're kind of more like folkloric studies. So there wasn't a strong ethnomusicological examination of the Beuron as such.
So it was originally then, if I'm understanding you correctly, it was your master's thesis that how it kind of started off.
That is, yeah. The initial interviews and kind of writing about it and thinking about it started there. Mm-hmm.
So you start fairly early on in terms of the history of the instrument. And the book is it's lovely to see. It's quite image heavy. Obviously, you're not able to go back to the 12th century necessarily with images. But just for listeners to realize that you convey a lot through the great images that you use in the book as well. But can you kind of condense for us, Colin, what surprised you the most or that kind of early history of what you can do in terms of tracking what maybe we now know as the Beuron or was referred to in different ways perhaps by different commentators?
The history, so there's one of the issues with the drum is that there's a lot of speculative histories in terms of its origins. In particular, you know, as a frame drum, it's a very simple design for an instrument. It's effective, but it's rather simplistic. And so you find that throughout different parts of the world, from Asia, you know, all the way to North America, Africa, et cetera. There's different versions of this, tambourines, samborellos, et cetera. So there's a sort of an interest by other people to see, well, did it come over from another tradition? Is it domestically created and it's just similar in construction because it's a circle with skin over it? And so there was these different sort of hypotheses. I mean, the one that made the most sense was that a really simple yet effective farming tool is that sieve. In Ireland, it was either the Wecht or the Dallan. You can find it in Cornwall. You can find it in Scotland, England. So it was Isle of Man. It was commonly used. And so that's just, it's a hoop. With skin at the bottom, and it was meant for separating the wheat from the chaff. So that would have been hung, you know, typically over the fireplace during the winter when it wasn't needed. And so just the nature of the design of it, it would have a natural resonance of just hitting the skin. And so it's thought to be taken down from there and eventually kind of used as an instrument. I think the most interesting thing is, you know, some of the difficulties with finding historical evidence, actual hard-based proof of this, is that, one, it's an instrument made of skin and wood, which decomposes. The fact that it could have this dual function as farming and musical instrument makes it slightly problematic in terms of the way in which it's referenced. And so there's also sort of the popular history of the drum, which is that it was a ritual instrument used rather infrequently, except for maybe on, you know, December 26th, Boxing Day, or when they used to hunt the wren and the wren boy tradition, which we can get into later if you like. But but really that it we really emerged with Seán Éireadh and Cultúrtha Cúlainn, and then with the chieftains. But what I found was speaking to other people is that the tradition was thriving, alive and well in certain areas of Ireland, particularly up in Sligo, where they had the hand striking tradition of using the hand against the drum, in Limerick, in other parts of the country where that existed in Beuron making was going on. So, sorry about that. Was going on during a lot of the sorry, can you hear that?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, don't worry.
What the heck? Anyways, but what I was saying there is that it was interesting to find that from 1910, 1920s, that there was Bauern makers, that there was Bauern playing, and that it was popular in certain areas of the country, whereas in other areas it might be unknown or not quite as popular. And so that was surprising, to find documentation of that, to interview people whose fathers made the Bauern. And so for me, that was the most interesting, I think.
Yeah, that's something actually, Colin, I wanted to ask you. I just happen to have a good friend of mine who lives here in New York, who's from the Ringgailtacht of Waterford, and he's into the Bauern and he plays it. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking about it, and it's something you've just referred to there. Are there places that you can identify? And I don't know, it just might be that my friend happens to be into it and he's from Ring and there was nothing to do with a tradition there. But can you tell us a little bit about that clustering of the tradition geographically in Ireland, in as much as you were able to kind of map that out in any meaningful way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the book, in order to find proof of when did this drum exist or come into existence, or at least we have evidence, I had to use paintings for one, to kind of to show the, you know, the existence of the drum. There's some references in terms of dictionaries of referencing the actual word Bauern. I mean, like Sligo has a very strong tradition in terms of Bauern playing and the tradition of playing with the hand. And so I went, it's also where there's a Junior Davy, who's a All-Ireland Bauern player, but also instructor. He has a Bauern Academy up there, which has produced just a wealth of great players, is in Gurcheen, Sligo. And so I went up there, and they have the Coleman Heritage Center. And so I met one of the people that works there. It was a guy named Owen Davy, whose father, Sonny Davy, was a great maker and player. And so, I mean, he was making them as early as the 1920s. And playing with different musicians, and continued throughout his life. And so from that, there was, you know, interviews with people who, you know, were sort of reminiscing about the different, you know, having different players there, and just basically the presence of the drum as sort of an accepted part of Irish traditional music, and this process of, you know, playing with the hands, and that there was a make, you know, an accomplished maker. You find this tradition as well. I spoke to a maker named Paddy Clancy, and he was talking about sort of the Bauern tradition in the Southwest and in Limerick and Tipperary to a degree. And
he's not the same Paddy Clancy of the Clancy brothers.
No, he's not. Yes, and he was in his 80s and was still occasionally making drums, and, you know, kind of was discussing in the book the sort of Renboy tradition of going around and from house to house and drumming and playing music for people and, you know, a bit of fun. But so there's some evidence and discussion of that sort of outside of, you know, or part of Irish traditional music, but something that's accepted as being in the tradition, as well as a bit in Kerry. So those areas seem to have a strong grounding of having the Bauern where and acceptance of it. I think the discussion I had with Paddy Clancy in Limerick was more of a ritual processional instrument, whereas particularly in Sligo, it was more of a discussion of having playing more than just on a holiday, that it was you know, part of the music making.
So can I ask you, I'm intrigued as to... So there's kind of a level of it, the Bauern not being accepted as a traditional Irish instrument. Is that, am I interpreting you correctly? Can you just tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, the instrument, like I was saying, it has its associations with the Renboy tradition, which really dates back to possibly, you know, sort of pagan festivals, activities, but it also has its linkages in sort of Christian lore as well. But, I mean, it's the idea is that the Baron was used to kind of chase out the Wren, thought to be the king of all birds. Bird is killed. And so, you know, that sort of the sun comes back into the sky after, you know, in the winter, and so the seasons move forward. So there's a lot of, in the book, there's some discussions of that sort of mythology and whatnot. So people are familiar with the drum in that sense. But in general, I mean, the drum, if it was used for accompaniment, it would, you know, it wasn't always that prevalent. When you speak to some of the makers, the discussions of actually even having quality drums was a question, because this is not a full-time profession by any means. For most makers, it still isn't. It was sort of for the love of drum making, either for themselves or for a local community. And so it just wasn't simply as popular. And if we think about the drum itself, the way it was played is either with the hand, and you have sort of the hand would strike it, and sort of the fat on the fingers and stuff mutes some of the overtones, so you get sort of a thump or an attack on it. But it's not, even if it's unmuted, it's not that loud. It can be, but it's typically, you know, it's not abrasive, let's say. When you see the shift where you have Sean O'Riordan introducing the drum as this sort of native drum on a stage, it shifts from being played with the hand to being played with sort of a very thick conical tipper by Potter Mercier, which on a stage fills it up. There's other instruments, and, you know, a number of instruments in an ensemble format, and it works, but it has a booming sound. And, you know, that kind of shift from a small locality where you'd be having people playing it with the hand to this larger stage is quite a difference in performance context. And because of the recordings later with the Chieftains, people start hearing this sound as being Baron playing. If you can imagine that in the 60s, when that sort of session music making makes its way into Ireland, or even just in a house session, and people are starting to, more people are playing the drum, you have instruments that may or may not be of quality, and you also have people who are, you know, imitating that style of playing unmuted, which is quite loud. And it's not a stage. If you're in a pub or somebody's house, that's going to fill up a lot more space. You can imagine if you're playing a tin whistle, a flute, and you have a booming Baron, that might not be the most appreciated. So it did have a negative stigma in the eyes of some, you know. You know, Seamus Ennis has that famous quote, the best way to play a Baron is with a penknife. So there was some people who felt that way. I remember, you know, I spoke to Seamus Tansey for the book, and, you know, I relayed that quote to him, and, you know, he said, well, what does Seamus Ennis know about Baron playing, and those are this sort of thing. So there's, and Seamus Tansey obviously plays the Baron with his hand, you know, from that area, Sligo, and a great flute player, obviously, as well. So, yeah, there is that kind of push and pull in terms of the role of the player, the way it sounds, and sort of where it's appropriate and where it's not. And that's still it's become more accepted, but it's still, you know, some of those tensions are still there.
So were you able to call in your research, because I realize the ethnographic part of it, right, you're limited in that you can only interview people who are alive and with us, so it's kind of, you know, skewing our viewpoint towards the 20th century, but you know, you clearly did a lot of research using documentary sources and things like that. From what you could gather, has, you know, I kind of, you know, off that point you've just made in terms of the different ways it was kind of performed in a different space and different scale, what was most common, or well, presumably most common, is the kind of in the house or in a smaller setting is probably what had been the tradition of it in the 19th century and earlier, or no? Are you able to kind of chart that out in any way?
Yeah, so for the performance practices, that's pretty difficult just because most of the evidence of that is pre-20th century is paintings. So we can gather a bit. There's different paintings of musicians playing together with the baron player. There's one painting where the person's playing with a stick. There's another one, or two of them, I think, with a stick, one with a hand. There's one, we see this sort of large frame drum being played with the hand as well. And it's in these social settings. So one is sort of at a dance. Another one is two people playing music in their house. There's one where it's outside, sort of in a picnic bucolic setting. So from that, we can kind of gather that a stick was used, a hand was used, and it's in a social setting playing with another melody player, at least, or groups of musicians. And that's from the 19th century. So we do have that. But in terms of what that really sounded like, the nature, you know, that becomes a bit difficult to really, you know, peg down. Yeah.
Can I ask you, Colin, pardon my ignorance in asking this question, but, I mean, your book's interesting in how it kind of forces you to think about these things, I guess, more explicitly because of the focus of it just on the drum itself. Is the Bowron only seen as an Irish instrument, or how does it kind of compare in terms of surrounding geographic areas, or more generally, if you go outside of Europe and stuff like that, do we see similar kinds of instruments, I guess, is my question.
You see that drum, that frame drum idea, is a very, very old instrument design. You know, I think in the book it goes very far back in terms of that, you know, evidence of that, going back to Roman times and even pre-Roman, in which we see, you know, evidence of a frame drum being used. So it certainly was prevalent in the Middle East, in North Africa, in different ways in sort of sub-Saharan Africa. It made its way, obviously, around the Mediterranean. You have the pandero. It's like a sort of larger tambourine that you find in Spain. You find the tamborello, which is, again, sort of a larger tambourine. In Italy, it made its way through France. And by the medieval period, you certainly have frame drums pretty much throughout Europe in different sizes, shapes, whether they have jingles on them, you know. And the approach in which how they're played depends as well, whether it's sort of a hand technique, if it's being hit with a stick, it depends on sort of the tradition. So it certainly was prevalent. If you think about the Roman occupation of England, certainly some of that may have made its way over, at least that far. I mean, in terms of Ireland, though, it is a unique tradition in the sense of how accompaniment works in Irish traditional music. Whether you're playing with a hand or stick is kind of interesting as well, sort of the materials being used there. But also later developments in the 20th century of placing the hand against the skin, and you're able to get a wide range of sounds out of the drum that can really kind of follow the melodic contour of Irish traditional music. So it's not just you're having a few tones, but you're really able to kind of follow the tune quite closely. And as a unique Irish percussion instrument, it does things that and has an accompaniment role that harkens to more to say a tabla or something like that in Indian classical music, where you're following the melody player and the range of tones and the ability to do glissandos, meaning sliding between pitches on the drum, is quite unique in terms of how frame drums are typically played.
That's really interesting. Maybe I'll ask this first question. So I think that you've one chapter, I think, dedicated entirely to, I guess I can tag these questions together, to the makers, the people who are making the Bowron. As you say, most of them are not, bar a couple of exceptions from what I could see, most of them are doing this for the love of it rather than as a full-time job, etc. but how have these people, the makers and the people, like the people who play the Balrog, how have they reacted? How do they, I mean, you interviewed quite a number of people. How did they take to this idea of kind of, in a way, I mean, and they may not be thinking of this way, but you're memorializing very important folkloric and ethnomusicological information in this way. How was that whole process in terms of, you know, kind of documenting these people?
Yeah, the you know, obviously the initial interviews started in 2007. And then there's a bit of a pause, and then they continued for, you know, about 2 years, I'd say about 2000, I think, 13 to 15, maybe. Anyways, in that kind of space. You know, it just went from interview to interview, transcribing this stuff, investigating it, getting grants to go visit makers, going to see how they things are created, or just doing something like this where it's kind of a video chat. You know, now that the book has come out, I mean, my my greatest fear in doing all this was, you know, when I was initially thinking of it as an article, they said there's way too much ethnographic material here for an article, which I agreed with, but I was like, I don't know how to scale this down. Because once you speak to these people, there was a feeling of, well, you need to do justice to the work they've done, to the time they've shared with you. And I have to say that the players and the makers were very generous. But they also said there hadn't been anything written about it, and they were, you know, there's a sense of wanting to legitimize this and to have their voices heard. So when I decided to write the book, I just wanted to make sure I did it right in terms of accurately representing what they were doing and kind of trying to explain it in a way that made sense to an audience, both academically and just the general public. But you never know how people are going to react to reading about themselves or reading about a tradition. So I've sent that out to the people who participated, and the feedback has been quite positive, which is a sigh of relief, because the last thing I want is to have a book out there documenting things and the people who are actually in it are not pleased with the way in which they're presented or their work is presented. So, the makers and the amount of time and sending you photos and discussion, it was, you could really see the passion behind the people involved with this.
And hopefully they appreciate, given the kind of gap in terms of the historiography, this is a very important intervention. I know all about that pressure. My own work, I do a lot of ethnographic stuff and oral histories, and I actually think that's more pressure than reviews or anyone more quote-unquote important in terms of assessing it as material. The best people to kind of assess what we do as writers are the people who've contributed to shaping that narrative, and as you say, that pressure to feel like you're doing justice to what they're doing and what they've done for you as a researcher, right?
Yes, yeah. So it was a sigh of relief, you know. And also, you know, I think they had one or two people go up there to interview different makers, and they weren't pleased with the product, whatever it was. And that was the craziness of it.
You write in the book, Colin, about how, you teach at a public school, and can you tell us a little bit about how, it's a really neat way to hear how you're bringing this instrument into a new realm. Can you share that a little bit with us in terms of a new generation and or perhaps students who might not necessarily have the opportunity to encounter the instrument?
Yeah, so I teach in New York City in a public high school in the Bronx, in the Theodore Roosevelt complex, which is like right across the road from Fordham University. So just kind of, when I got to the school, I'd done my dissertation research and all that stuff, and that research was actually looking at how samba and choro in Brazil and Rio de Janeiro was being taught in public schools. So I had sort of some different conceptual groundwork for how I wanted to teach when I returned. So I teach piano, music tech, and world percussion. So I had a natural world music kind of approach to the curriculum. And so the curriculum was based, my idea was that I would have better engagement if we co-created the curriculum. Because there's no regents or anything for music, thank God. It's just you can create it as you see fit. So we had some percussion instruments, and I just asked the students, what type of music do you want to do? And so there was, they made some suggestions of, doing stuff from Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic, et cetera. I had some ideas. I wanted to do some Brazilian samba. But I also, on my lunch breaks, the kids would come up to the music room to hang out or whatever, and I'd always be practicing the Bauron. So they were always kind of curious, what is this guy up to when he's not just teaching, congas and snare drums and bass drums and kit and all that stuff. They want to try and play it. So I said, okay, have a go at it and, have some fun and whatnot. So they knew I played that drum. So I had decided that, I'm a big fan of pushing the students to go, not just to play for their parents, which is great, in the school, but to actually play concerts in the public. Because especially in high school, that really sharpens, when you feel that social pressure, it really sharpens the students in terms of their musical skills and to get out there and to, feel like you're actually a gigging musician of some sort, as opposed to just sort of a horse and pony show. In a school auditorium. I'm not knocking school auditoriums. It's great. I love the concerts. They're amazing. But sometimes you get that feeling. It's a bit of a safer space. So I had contact St. Pat's for All, which has been, doing parades and promoting equality for years. And so I said, I want to march in it. And we have a percussion ensemble. At the time, we were doing a lot of Brazilian stuff, but more like stick drumming in terms of snare, bass drum. So we marched in that, which was great. But the guy who was sort of one of the musical directors for the benefit concert that they have at the Irish Arts Center is a guy named Brian Fleming. And he's in the book, actually. There's a discussion of him in Bauron solos, and he's in there. So he came to the school and just happened to be a Bauron player. So he came into the school just to kind of chat to the kids, hey, what type of music are you playing? And he had a Bauron with him and some bones, And so he did a thing and sang a song and he had a solo and the kids are like, oh, we know that drum. He plays that. So I had talked to Brian in advance and I had done, Bauron workshops outside of the school for, for the public, different events. And I had just a giant, and I mean giant industrial-sized garbage bag filled with frame drums, all sorts, anything I could get my hands on. And as many tippers as I could, I had asked people to donate Bauron's and tippers. Like Malachy Kearns from Roundstone in Galway was very nice and donated some sticks, tippers and drums. And so we had these. So we had a Bauron workshop, which was great. So the kids all played, getting sounds. It's amazing you see people, like some students, which is unusual ergonomically because you're just going back and forth kind of, almost like you're opening and closing a door handle. So that sort of wrist movement isn't always the easiest. And some of these kids just picked it right up. So some happy days. So we had a concert at some point in the auditorium, and I got them up, and we had some Irish musicians come in, and they played the Bauron, just to accompaniment. So they had a good bit of fun, loved it. Went to the Irish Arts Center for the parade, marched in the parade, had a good time. So we continued that each year. And the percussion ensemble shifted. I got a grant, and some of the students said, oh, we're doing a lot of interesting stuff from DR and PR, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico. We have a sizable student population, a West African student population, so they wanted to do some stuff there. So we got a grant. We got in a professional Ghanaian drummer, and he's still with us, a great guy named Amos Gabia. And we've been playing like the Johnny Pacheco Land Jazz Festival and other things. But we also do the Irish Arts Center benefit concert each year. So this year, we have like a it was like a 16, 17 student choir. They sang Irish songs, you know, kind of classics, Molly Malone, that sort of thing. We had Irish musicians come in. I taught the kids a few marches and reels on the piano, and then I taught the percussion students the baron to accompany that. And they played in the school, and then we went down to the Irish Arts Center and did that for half the show, and then we played our West African percussion stuff for the second half. And it was a ball. It was a lot of fun. So I know I'm going on about this, but I do enjoy the mixing it up. And, you know, it's great as a teaching tool, because if you have students who know what it is, it's great. But if you don't know what it is, it's sort of a mystery of, like, what do I do with this thing? And so a lot of the percussion students had these compositions in their mind, you know, cumbia or, you know, West African pieces or what else? We mambo, for example, right? And so then it was a question of, well, how do you take the different rhythm patterns and sounds that you associated with something like mambo and map it on the baron? And so they figured out how to do that, and it's sort of a creative exercise. And the kids enjoyed that. So I try and mix that in. And that informs my own baron playing as well, is this kind of taking world musics and figuring out how to work them in or play them either in that context, like, say, if I'm, you know, playing, which I do at times, play with a percussion ensemble on the baron, even though it's not part of that tradition, or bring in the opposite, bring in those music forms into Irish trad or folk. So it's a long-winded answer, but...
No, but it's great. As you say, it's not only for the students, but for you as the educator to... isn't that the best? And it really goes to show the universality or the reach of music as a way, as a common language, in terms of how people can pick it up. And to your point, some of the kids' dexterity in terms of sometimes just taking to things in ways that are surprising to us as we're older.
Yeah, well, it's great to see. Some of you say, wow, that's some natural talent. You know, it's funny, so we had done this each year, and the choir last year, I guess they sang some Irish songs, you know, but they had just done it for the auditorium concert. They hadn't done it at the Irish Arts Center. And the choir was not intending on doing Irish songs, because I was waiting on getting some funding to pay to have these musicians come in, these Irish musicians, and we were just going to do percussion for the Irish Arts Center concert. So March rolls around, we have this one student, and, you know, she's from West Africa originally, and, you know, I had brought in the West African drumming. So without my intervention, she had given out to the choir teacher saying, hey, why aren't we doing Irish songs this year? What's going on? I've talked to the choir, and we all want to do these Irish songs. So the choir teacher told me and said, are you fermenting an uprising? What's going on here? Like, are you trying to, you know, throw my curriculum under the bus? I said, no, I had no idea at all. So I approached the student, and I was laughing because I said, you're looking to do the Irish songs just as great, and sure, aren't I trying to do all this West African stuff? So it was a sort of a happy meeting of the mind. And they sounded great, I have to say. The choir really did. I don't teach the choir. There's another music teacher that does it, but they really did a wonderful job with it, so it was nice
well,
to see.
You know, Colin, it reminds me, I know this gentleman who grew up in Chelsea in Manhattan when it was really at the end of it being an Irish enclave in the way that it had been, and it was, you know, changing over ethnically primarily. When he was born, he was the youngest of the family. It was like predominantly Puerto Rican, et cetera, et cetera. And he tells a great story, which what you're telling me reminds me of, you know, I actually imagine this every year, how the nuns in the local Catholic school were all still at this point very elderly, mainly Irish American nuns. I can't remember which school it is, but somewhere there in Chelsea. But the demographic of the school was there were hardly any Irish children still in the school. But every year, long after the demographics had changed, there was I think it was a play they would do for St. Patrick's Day. And he said, well, they used to get such a kick out of it because, you know, none of the kids were Irish, but here they were doing this very Irish performance. And, you know, it's so important, like all these you know, questions of and accusations and kind of, kind of barriers put up in terms of who can do what and these questions of appropriation and stuff like that, that, you know, really the spirit of the arts and music in particular is, you know, really boundary-less in that sense, but how sometimes these attachments and labels of identity are invoked in these ways that are really not in the spirit of the art form as they have evolved over time, or how people naturally gravitate to wanting to do these things and share in them, and that cross-fertilization, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. Yeah. Yeah, no, let me see that.
Yeah. Listen, congratulations on the book. Again, it's called The Bowron: Experimentation, Innovation, and the Traditional Frame Drum. It's by Colin F. Hart. It's published by the University of Tennessee Press. Congratulations, Colin, and thank you for coming on the program today to educate me, at least, and I'm sure some of our listeners find this very interesting to contextualize the history of this instrument that is so recognizably Irish, but to kind of lay it out in a wider context is very helpful, and thanks again for doing this.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being on here, and it was a pleasure chatting with you. I always enjoy talking about the drum, so that's great.
Thank you so much.
And that was my conversation with Colin Hart. Now, to close us out, folks, before we wrap up, I want us to take a listen to Glenn Hansard singing The Parting Glass at Glucksman Ireland House.
And of all the money that e'er I spent, I spent it in good company. And of all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was through none but me. And for all I've done, for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So raise to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all. And to all the comrades that e'er I had, who might be sorry for my going away. And to all the sweethearts that e'er I've loved, who would bid me one more day to stay. And as it falls upon my lot, that I should rise and you should not, I will gently rise and softly call. Good night and joy be with you all. Now this song is about saying goodbye or good night, which is a much lighter goodbye. But really what it means is good night in the bigger sense. And this song, in Irish tradition, is sang at the wake of a person. And so the idea is that everyone's gathered, bodies in the coffin, we're having a party, we're drinking, we're telling stories about the person. And then at some point, the person rises to say thank you. This song is sung from the perspective of the corpse, who will then say, thanks everybody for being my family, thanks for loving me, I'm off to a better place. I'll put in a good word for you all. I'll keep an eye on you. I'm always available. And so, it's a kind, and also it's just a good way to end an evening of chit-chat. And if I had money enough to spare and leisure time to sit a while, there is a girl in this fair land who surely has my heart beguiled. With her long dark hair and ruby lips, she surely has my heart in thrall. So raise to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all. Will you join me on that just a second? So raise to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all.
We're coming towards the end of the show. I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, as well as on irishradio.com. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.